Good afternoon. So last time we started by reviewing exceptions and what I felt was both unsuccessful for not boring people who already got it and helping people who did. But so I'm going to talk a little more about that. But we said exceptions fundamentally are the way hardware runs the OS, and there's lots of types of events which trigger it, which I think is where a lot of the confusion comes from, because you know this is one hardware mechanism with all these different causes. We had the program requests, the system calls, we had I/O devices needing something to happen, we had problematic events in programs. All these things would cause the same hardware mechanism to run the OS. We also talked a bit about signal handling, which I'll get to later. And one thing I think in particular I probably went over poorly was, well, I had this slide from when we were talking about exceptions, talking about kind of the typical timeline for what a sort of reading input works like. So in this scenario, we have a program that's reading input. It makes a system call asking for input, and the OS realizes that, oh, there's not input right now, and does something else. That something else is running some programs I'm representing in green and purple here. And then the keyboard triggers an exception, one of those other causes that causes the OS to realize, oh, there's keyboard input, and then it decides to run a program. And this is a very common pattern we see, and what I was hoping students would apply on the quiz in part. And it's probably worth going over explicitly, and also I realized it probably should have also been gone over explicitly in the kernel reading, so I added a section at the end on it. And sort of, there's kind of two common things which happen when you're getting input on a system. And note that we need to kind of have the exceptions involved, because in order to talk to the input device, we need a kernel mode. We can't do that in user mode, because generally it's going to be shared between multiple programs, so the OS code that runs in kernel mode needs to manage it. And there's kind of two cases when you try to read something from the keyboard or from the network. One case is that the input's already there. So what would have happened is sometime earlier, something else was happening or you were running, and the device said, oh, I have a new packet or I have a new key press, and it told the processor, and the processor used an exception to run the OS. And the OS copied that data somewhere. And then later on, you request, say, hey, I'd like that data from the keyboard or from the network, and the OS will just say, oh, I stored that earlier, here you go. Now, sometimes you ask to read from the keyboard and the user hasn't typed anything yet. Or you ask to read from the network and you haven't gotten anything from wherever you're getting it yet. In that case, you tell the operating system the same thing. Hey, I want to read input. And generally, the handler for that request is going to say, well, can't help you now. I'm going to run other things until I can. And then later on, it will learn, oh, now there's input. It will fetch that input and then give it to you. And possibly run you right away. Or it turns out sometimes it will wait to run you until later, but it will realize, no, now I can run you sometime. Because now you have the input you were waiting for. So questions about these kind of typical patterns for how we interact, our programs interact with the operating system and devices to get input. Yeah?
So I remember from the quiz, it listed step two on that like big list of steps as a system call starting as the OS like essentially waiting for input. Would that system call essentially be like always active, or like how it says on there, like I have input now, OS stores input for later? Does the input become pending?
So the question was, on the quiz we've had the step where a program waits for input, and the question is that system call always active? So a confusing part about this is that there's kind of two things we call a system call. One is the actual sort of exception, the call itself, and one is the code which runs as a result of that. And we have the same issue in the terminology for a function call. When I say we make a function call to main, I could be referring to, this is part of the function call, I could be referring to what the function does, like what main does, or I could just be referring to the process of starting main. So we're referring to the process of starting the system call that happens there, and then some other stuff happens, which is this process, and the waiting is part of that, but you know, the actual initiating of the system call is not that waiting. But part of processing the system call, yes, you know, what the handler is doing is causing your program to wait. And kind of that operation, that request you made is pending until it's finished, until you actually get the data or an error. Does that answer your question?
So is it always active or not?
Question, is it always active? So the exception just happens once. And it starts, it basically runs a function that's still pending until it's done. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
OK, other questions up there? Yeah.
Are there context switches in the first case?
Question, are there context switches in the first case? So there are no required ones, but you know, in here, we don't know what happens. So stuff happens. And that stuff could involve whatever. Just whatever's happening on the machine in between when the input comes in, when you request it. In the other case, yeah, I've listed explicitly that there's definitely a context switch. And in addition, we could have stuff happen here that could involve more context switches. Does that answer your question? Question, we're defining a context switch as going between two different things that generally run in user mode. Yeah, I would say between two different, yeah. You said user threads, that would probably be the precise terminology. Yes, between two different threads that run normal non-OS code. Is like the context switches we're thinking of here. Even though, yes, there are context switches between stuff that's entirely internal to the kernel that we're kind of going to ignore because we're not going to talk in detail about how do you write an OS. That's, if you want to take 4414, you'll learn about that. Other questions? Yeah?
So does the context switch happen because the timer runs out or just because there's an input?
Question, does the context switch I have underlined here happen because the timer runs out? Or just because there's no input? Just because there's no input. Basically, the OS, whenever it's running, it wants to use the processor for something useful. And in this case, it knows the program needs the input before it can do anything, so there's nothing useful to do. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the question is, for the second case, the OS is learning about the input from the device, not from setting a timer or something like that, is your question?
It's choosing to context switch, not because it's setting a timer and waiting for it, but because it asks, do I have input? No, it context switch.
Question, so in the second case, it's choosing the context switch because it's asking the device if it has input and finding out it doesn't. And therefore doing so? Yes, with the caveat that probably it's not even asking the device, it just knows the device would tell me if it had input, and that hasn't happened, therefore I don't have input. Let's do something useful, which is not running this program that needs input. Other questions? Yeah. When the OS switches back to the program, will that also require a context switch? Yes. OK, other questions? OK, and it turns out output kind of has similar patterns too. So when we ask to output something, we make a system call requesting to do the output. And two kind of things can happen. One is that the device is ready to accept that output right away. This is usually probably the common case, which case, as part before that we go back to the program, we can just have your output on that device, sent on the network, put on the screen, et cetera. In some cases, the device won't be ready. Like if our network has lots of stuff going on it, it can only send it so fast. So it might say, I can't take more input. In which case, often the device will trigger an exception to tell the OS, hey, now I'm ready for more input. And in that case, when you request to send input, the OS will remember that request and actually finish it later. And it varies whether it will go back to you while that's happening or whether it will have you wait until that finishes, depending on sort of what type of device you're talking to and what you've asked the OS to do. Questions on output? OK. And related to this, one thing we did in grading the quiz is we accepted the idea that waiting for input would be basically asking, is there input out? Is there input out? In a loop, and therefore accepted there being a timer to switch to the other program based on that. Because we know you did some similar things like that in CSO1, even though that's not the typical pattern. And when I'm writing programs, I try to avoid doing that because it's slow. Also, I was confused because I had a bunch of comments arguing that there would be divide by zero in the long computation. This is why I wrote the word likely in the question, because I assumed you wouldn't think it was likely that we'd like have seg faults or divide by zeros. I need to think of how can I phrase this to get that across. Question or? And there were some anonymous feedback about generally quizzes being hard, so hopefully I've illustrated what I missed teaching that wasn't intentional, but it is intentional that like you can't find a specific thing in the sentence in the reading that will answer every quiz question, that they have more complexity than that sort of thing. So the other topic we talked about was signal handling, which you did a bunch of in the lab yesterday. So we mentioned that this is the way the OS calls a program to handle a special event, kind of like the hardware called the OS. And we had these kind of two key functions that you've now hopefully used. We had sig action to register a function to be called when a signal happens. And we had kill to trigger a signal in a particular program kind of manually. We also mentioned that signals would be triggered by other things like control C or set or accessing memory you're not supposed to and things like that. But we can also trigger them deliberately with this kill function. I mentioned that, even though like we wrote signal handlers and we're gonna do so again in a homework, that it turns out that if you're writing like software that needs to work reliably, that this is extra challenging because library functions generally aren't written to be interrupted by a signal and called again. That it's really hard to write functions where unexpectedly in the middle of your function, someone calls you again. And for this reason, like you can't safely do things like use malloc in a signal handler if someone might have pressed control C to run that signal handler while you were mallocing something else. Because malloc is not written to handle that scenario, and it makes sense because it would be really annoying to write malloc that way. And we mentioned to kind of control when signals happen, which we might want to do because of that sort of lack of safety issue, we have this support for this notion of blocking signals. So normally, like our signals are acted on, meaning they start a handler or they cause our program to terminate. If we block it, instead the signal becomes pending, and then we can check for whether a signal's pending and remove it from the list of pending signals, or unblock it to make it be actually delivered, to make it do its action. So we have ways of doing things with the pending signals instead of just relying on sort of having our signals always immediately cause a handler to run or a program to immediately be terminated. Question?
Can you block like sig kill, or does that count as handling as you can't do it?
Can you block sig kill, or does that count as handling as you can't do it? you can mark say kill is blocked and it won't do anything. Other questions? Yeah. Question sig action causes the function to be called on a signal? Yes. So you're telling, yeah, and it tell I'm saying it's registering it as in like it's causing the OS to do the bookkeeping of writing down that this is the function I call on that signal. Other questions about signals or lingering questions about the exception stuff we talked about earlier? And just to review, kill does. So we had this example, which from last time, which I've done, just a variation of that. So an example of like sig action, right? Remember, we had this struct we set up, and we could register a handler for it. And then, you know, that means that this function will be called if someone else triggers sig user one. And in this case, I have a call to kill here. That's for a different PID, for PID 2000. So let's say PID 2000 has some code here, where PID 2000 registers two handlers and then just waits. So as an example, when you run this, you know, first, both of these programs are going to run their setup code, and then you know, they're both going to go beyond that and keep running. And then we have this kill happen. And something I want to get across is that when we do this kill, it sends the signal to the program, but the signal might not be received immediately. So, you know, after this kill executes, it might be we might still be here. And sometime in between when we finish up the kill and when we start doing, and while we're in that loop there, we will actually start running the handler that was registered for user one. So it's not immediate, but it's just kind of set up to happen soon. And in the lab, you may remember that we told you that you should like check for the outbox saying that it's, you know, being reset to know when you can send the next message, and this is why. Because even though you did a kill, like that kill doesn't guarantee that the program actually handled that yet. It just guarantees that you sent it and it will be handled soon. So questions? This timing issue? And if we trace what happens in this set of programs, we can see that, okay, so this triggers us to print X, and then we send a signal back. And so we send the signal back while the first program is running that loop. And we're going to go back. We're going to finish this kill call and go back to where we were before, which is the loop at the bottom. So sometime, either while we're finishing up this kill here, or while we go back to this while loop that we were in before the signal happened, the first program will run its handler. But again, it's the case that kill just says it's going to start the handler soon. It doesn't make it happen right away. And so then this program, in this case, would print out Y and send the signal back again. And that would cause us to print out Z and terminate the other program and accept. So questions? This example here. Yeah? How does it know to do handle user 2 when we do kill 2000? So we're sending the signal to 2000, which is this program over here, and we've registered a separate handler for user 2 with the second sig action call. And we can have different handlers for different signals if we want to do that. Yes?
Is it more conventional to have different handlers for different signals, or the same handler with like if statements or checks?
The question, is it more conventional to have different handlers for different signalers, or one handler with if statements? I don't know that the world has a preference. Question is, will this always print XYZ? Yes, as long as sleep 60 is long enough to ensure the other program finishes setting up. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, why do I have this comment mentioning initializing act when I'm already declaring it? So because act in this case is a local variable, its initial contents are going to be whatever's on the stack. It's not set to anything well-defined, so if we want to make sure fields have particular values, we need to do that. And this can be tricky because often you'll write code assuming like, oh, it's always going to be zero, but it's not actually guaranteed. It could be something else just based on what was using the stack before. Other questions? Yeah.
How does the parameter play in, like, what's its role in this?
Question, what's the parameter to the signal handler num? What's that for? So signal handlers always get as an argument the identifier for the signal. So in this case, it would be sig user 1 or sig user 2. Because I have separate handlers for both of them, I don't need to check num to know what's happening, so I just don't check it. But if I was checking it, it would always be in this function. In this function, it would always be sig user 1. And in this function, it would always be sig user 1. And in this function, it would always be sig user 2. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and I'm also going to ask, where does sig term go? Like, where do you handle sig term here?
Question, where do I handle sig term? I do not have a handler for it, so the default thing happens. And the default action for sig term is the program is killed, it as in terminates. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. Question, when I change what act is after the first sig action call, how does that not override it? When you call sig action, it makes a copy of the information that's in the action you provide. Other questions, comments? Okay, so related to signals, some things that on the lab, that the lab I say think was a little longer than I wanted, apparently adding something about how scanf works in the write-up was not enough, and I probably should just have given you code that reads PIDs without having an extra new line that caused a lot of people to get seg faults from things not being initialized, and those are hard to debug. And also, I guess I need to be clearer that M on map was a sort of freeing step for the shared memory you created. So mmap was kind of like malloc for it, mmonmap was kind of like free. And our code snippet had both because we were kind of trying the whole process of using it, but a lot of people missed that what was going on. One thing that probably will come up on other assignments is I saw a lot of people who had issues with seg faults where we probably need to practice debugging things you hopefully know from CSO1, like using a debugger. So it turns out when the debuggers always have breakpoints set automatically for whenever a signal happens or a segfault happens. So if you just run your program in a debugger, you can type continue until the segfault happens, and you can find out where it is. And that's often more reliable than relying on print statements. In particular, in the signals lab, it was a lot more helpful because often people didn't realize the segfault was in their signal handler. And you know, why would they think it's there? Because they, you know, something weird was going on, and the debugger would have been one way to figure that out. Also, I think, so, and our graders use address sanitizing. I think you used it once in CS01, I hope. And usually it will tell you a line number where the thing that's causing the segfault is. So I recommend using it for that reason, because that usually saves a lot of time. Questions about things related to the lab? Okay, so if you look on the schedule, we have an upcoming assignment, which is due next week, on timing. So you're going to time how long it takes to run an empty function call. So call an empty function. Call a system call that's very simple and get its result back. Run another program to start a signal handler. So send a signal to your own process and have the signal handler start. And to send a signal to another program and have it send a signal back. And your lab code, you know, should be helpful for the last part, especially. So that's going to be sort of the assignment. And we're going to want you to submit sort of a text file of the timings you got. We want you to take multiple measurements so you know it's like that you weren't only timing when someone was compiling, so it was really slow. So you have like a couple measurements, so we have like some idea that whether it's consistent, and just to have like a text file reporting on the observations you had. And we want to have whatever data your program output that you needed for that. It doesn't need to be all the data points. Like if your program like takes a bunch of measurements and takes an average, I just need that, and just outputs the average, I just need that average. On the other hand, if you got a bunch of measurements by and averaged them by hand, I need all those measurements. I just need to reproduce what you did. So if the numbers are weird, we know what happened. Questions on the timing assignment? Okay. And something which comes up on this assignment is related to that issue of when kill runs a signal handler. So I told you earlier that when I call kill, it's going to make the signal handler run at some point in the future. There's an exception to this rule for killing the current process. And in that case, it's guaranteed that the signal handler will run before kill returns. But it's only if you're killing the current process. Otherwise, it might run immediately, it might run and if you might run a little later. You don't know. Yeah?
Is this also true for arrays?
Question is, also true for arrays? Yes. So arrays is another function that will deliberately send a signal to a program. Okay. Other questions? Yeah?
What is kill return?
What is kill return? I would have to look it up. It somehow will tell you if it fails. An example of why it would fail is if you're killing a program that doesn't exist. Does that answer your question, ish? Other questions? Okay, so, and some other anonymous feedback stuff before we go on to the actual new material. So one thing is that on the study materials tab, I have had a link to the spring 2023 quizzes to start to look at if you wanted to do that, and it didn't work. That is fixed now. And that link is there, by the way. Someone who asked about TAs leaving will look into that and follow up on live examples, sort of hoping that I do things that sort of show the structure of programs we want to write more and how to understand things better. So I know I'll try to think of how to do that. If I just do live examples, they might not do this because they'll be very scripted. But I can try to think of how I can try to do that. And also go slower in lecture. I am working on it. And also generalized feedback on, we don't understand anything, or gosh, could you spend, or more useful feedback with like, could you spend time like going over examples and things like that. If you just want to rant, it's fine for the first comment. If you just want to rant, it's fine, but without specifics, I'm going to guess what you don't understand, and I'm probably wrong. So just keep that in mind. But if you want to rant, it's okay, but specifics are useful and things I can act on that makes it much more useful. Okay, so we've talked about system calls as the way we access I/O devices. So that's what we started with. And one thing we mentioned related to that is that, you know, we have the kernel responsible for arbitrating who can access what when we have shared resources, like a shared hard drive. So if I ask to open a file, and this is the system call wrapper I can call to do that, so you've probably used fopen. Fopen makes a system call, and this is how you call that system call wrapper. So the system call directly has these two parameters, a file name, and sort of whether to open it for reading, writing, etc. And when the handler for the system call is running, it needs to know whether it should say, here's your file, it's open, or say, no, you can't do that. So how does it get the information to do that? And you can see that it needs some extra data, because all we have in that system call there is a file name and we're reading it. So we need some more information. And there's a particular type of more information that that Linux systems track that it's going to use for this. And that information is, going to be user IDs. So we're going to have every process, in addition to tracking like what memory it has and its threat information about its threads, the OS is going to track its user ID. And there's going to be some procedure we're going to do, we'll talk about that later, that sets the user ID for every process. And that user ID is how we're going to decide whether you're allowed to open files or not, and so on. And on Unix-like systems, they follow a standard called POSIX, and POSIX has this function to get the current user ID. So this function get EUID. Which gets the effective user ID. You might wonder, why is it effective user ID? Are there other user IDs? Yes, there are. There's something called set user ID, which means the program actually has a couple other user IDs, but this is the important one. And therefore the one we'll be talking about, this effective user ID. And this is a UID key, and this is a number. So this is some sort of integer. And that's, on Unix-like systems like Linux, that's all the kernel knows about. All that OS code knows about is a number. It doesn't know usernames. Other code maintains that mapping. So on Linux, the kernel code just knows these numbers, but libc knows how to translate those numbers to names and vice versa when we need to do that for programs like ls that list files and shows who owns them, and other things like that. And generally, there's either a file that contains that mapping, or if on some shared machines like our like Portal, there's some network server that gives that mapping to programs. Yeah?
You mentioned that like one process can have multiple user IDs, but like, the effective one is like the one that counts. I know sometimes in the terminal you can like run sudo to get permission to do something that you otherwise wouldn't. Is that like a situation where it might like use the other user ID to be able to say like, okay, even though you're here, you put in your password, so we're giving you permission now, so we're going to use this other user ID.
So the question is, are the other user IDs used for things like sudo, which let you get more permissions than you normally have? The answer is yes, but not in the way you're thinking. Okay. We'll talk about specifically how sudo works later. And it is related to that kind of scenario, why there are other user IDs. Typically, when your programs are running, all the user IDs will be equal. And this is the only one the OS is actually checking, so it's the only one that really matters for typical scenarios. There's just weird exception scenarios where that's not the case. Other questions? Okay, so in addition to user IDs, it turns out there's some other IDs that systems like Linux track, which are groups, which are tracked by group IDs. And your programs have an effective group ID and also a list of additional group IDs. So you can be in lots of groups at once, and in fact, unlike user IDs, all these IDs matter. Whenever the operating system's checking, if you're allowed to do something, if the group IDs matter, it's going to look at every single one to see if you're allowed to do that thing. And I can run a command on department machines. I'm running on not Portal, but you could run a command like this on Portal that will print out my user IDs, my group IDs, and my group list. So you can see here that at the time I ran this, this was my user ID on the department machines, this number 858182, and my primary group ID was 21, which this program looked up the name in a database and found out, oh, that's the CS faculty group. So we have a group for all CS faculty stuff. And also, I also have the group for instructors and for, at the time, CS 4414. And those names were looked up just in a database. The operating system itself is just tracking the numbers. Yeah?
So the kernel only knows about the 858182, and it's used by your computer to give you authorization to that.
So the question is, the kernel only knows about the 858182? So the kernel knows all the numbers here. The 858182 is by far the most important of them. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So for the code in the C standard library, is that like code that maintains the mapping protocol? Or?
The question is, the code in the C standard library, code that maintains the mapping protocol? Yes. So there's some code that, yeah. So there's a function that Linux provides that like knows how to take a ID and give you a name. And it's going to work by, you know, how it's going to work depends on how the system administrator configured the system. Does that answer your question? Yeah, up there.
Is the first group listed always the effective group?
Question is, the first group listed always the effective group? So this ID program I'm running, it called get EGID to figure out what to output for the thing that says GID equals, and it called get groups to figure out what to output for the rest. But hypothetically, we could set the group list to have those numbers in any order. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so from what I've shown you here, it seems like that the groups are kind of redundant with the user, right? That knowing that it's the user for me tells you that, oh, the CS faculty group applies. This isn't always the case. So for example, some systems will have a group called video for access to the monitor. And programs running in the video group will be allowed to access the monitor and other programs won't. So if I SSH in, I won't be in the video group. If I log in person, I will. So this is something you might see. So the groups don't have to like tell you more about the user. They can be kind of extra information. I don't think this is actually that useful to do, but you'll see systems do it. The reason I don't think it's useful is like if I log in person, I can just have a program running in the background forever and nothing's gonna change its groups. So it's still gonna be in the video group, and that's maybe not really intended. Yeah. Question, when you start your program, will the OS put it in the video group? It needs to be there. So as we'll learn later, the program that's primarily responsible for assigning users and groups IDs is whatever program handles you logging into the system. So that program is going to be the one that assigns your programs whatever user and group IDs it wants. Other questions? Okay, so we've learned about this information we're tracking about our programs, about their user IDs and group IDs, representing who's running them. And we need to translate this to a notion of what files can you access. And in Unix, we have what we'll learn is called an access control list of a very restricted form of information we can supply about files that tells us who can access it. So every file has a user ID and three bits of information about that user ID, whether that user can read the file, write the file, and execute the file. And also, if you are running as the user ID that's associated with the file, you are considered the owner, and you are allowed to change all of these settings, all these bits, I should say. We also have a single group ID associated with the file, and correspondingly, whether programs running with that group ID are allowed to read, write, or execute. And we have a default setting for programs which don't match the user ID or the group ID of whether they can read, write, or execute. And these settings apply to normal files as well as directories. On directories, the bit for execute means search, meaning can you access things that are in the directory if you know their name. So basically, we have this list of who can access things, but it's a very restricted format. We can't just list anybody. We can list one user, and that user also can change all these settings. We can list one group, and we can list what everyone else gets to do. Questions? Okay, and you may have and we have these. So we have these bits, and if we count here, we have 9 of them. And we can encode those bits as a number, and commonly that is done. And we write that number in octal, base 8. So we have 3 bits in each digit we're writing. And they're generally written in the order where we have the user, the group part, and the other part in that order. And you'll commonly see people talk about permissions on a Unix system in this way. So for example, 700 means the user part is 7, the group part is 0, and the other part is 0. So if the user part's 7, well, in binary, that's going to be 111, and the 3 bits are going to be in order read, write, execute. So that's going to be read and write and execute for the user. So first, a program running with the right user ID. If a program just matches the group ID and doesn't match the user ID, its bits are 000, so it has none of those. And the same if a program matches neither the user or group ID. And similarly, we can look at the second scenario. We have 451. So programs running that match the user ID have 100. So we have a read as what they can do, and they can't write or execute. Programs running with the right group have 101, so they can read and execute but not write. And programs running as other can execute because they have 001. Questions? So here we have these permissions. So one thing that you might strike you as a bit weird is, gosh, the user who's the owner of the file has less access to it than other people. And this is true in the sense that that the file being set this way means that the user can't try to execute it and can't open it for writing. That will fail. But the user can change the permissions. So it's kind of like a false restriction. They can, you know, adjust the 4 to a 7 if they want to. So they aren't really restricted, but it is the case that until they do that, open or, you know, running a program with that in that file will fail. Questions? Sorry. Yeah. Question, in terms of directory, how would we have execute a search permission and not read or write? So read permission on a directory lets you list the files in the directory. Search permission on the directory lets you access files within that directory. So those are two separate things on in the Unix design. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, do these permission encoding have anything to do with running a program as administrator? Not really, but we'll have to talk about something similar, related later, which does involve these bits in a way. Other questions? Okay, so the command you can use to change these bits is chmod. That's also the name of the library function call if you want to do it in a C program. And you can write out these three octal digits to change it for files. You can also kind of write out in a more symbolic way, which you might find a lot simpler to understand. And very commonly, when you're changing permissions on a file, what you want to do is not actually like set the permissions to a specific thing, you often want to add or remove permissions. And chmod supports that too. So here I can say u plus rx, meaning I want to give the user of the file read and execute permission plus, you know, I want to keep all the other stuff the same. I just want this in addition to the settings the file already has. Whereas here, you know, I said, I want to set it so the user can read, write, and execute, and everyone else has nothing. But here I'm just saying, add and read and execute. If it already has write for the user, it will end up being read, write, execute. If it doesn't, it just ends up being read, write. And if others or the group has access, that won't change. And similarly, I can ask to remove certain permissions and set them. So here I could say, remove people who aren't in the user groups read, write, and execute permissions, and set my permissions to not write, be able to write it, you know, maybe to keep myself from accidentally overwriting it or something like that. Yes?
Who's allowed to use chmod? Is it like only the user is it only like the owner of the file, or is it only the root, or can it be like adjusted?
So the question is, who's allowed to chmod? It's only the owner of the file and, as we'll discuss later, the system administrator in a way. Yeah?
So for the group,
For groups, is the would it be G instead of O or U? Yes. Yeah.
So if there are no permissions, does that mean you have to add? I guess I'm a little confused as to the difference between adding user permissions and setting user permissions.
So the question, what's the difference between adding user permissions and setting user permissions? So let's say foo was originally, let's say foo for the user part was originally read-write. In this case, it would go to read-write-execute. If it was originally, say, read-only, it would go to just read-execute. So it's paying attention to what the original permissions were in the process. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, questions? So this system for setting permissions is useful, but very inflexible. And one of the ways in which it's inflexible is if you don't have a group set up for the people who are supposed to access the file, well, you're out of luck. And who sets up those groups? The system administrator, hopefully. So there's a more flexible mechanism, which are sort of called access control lists. And this is just like a list of users and groups and the things they can do. So rather than having only one user and one group, let's just have a list of as many users as you want and as many groups as you want and what they can do. And this is supported by Windows and also is supported kind of by Unix systems, but it depends on how the drive you're on is formatted, whether it will work. And we will have a lab next week where we will use these access control lists. And they have, on Unix systems, they have this format. And so we have this kind of like file that's like a configuration file for who can access another file. And I can specify groups and whether they can read, write, or execute. I can specify users and whether they can read, write, or execute. And there's a rule about what do we do when user and group both applies, and the rule is that the user takes precedence over group rules. Okay. Some questions on this example here. So here we have, I've said it, so programs running with the students group can read or execute this file. Programs running in the faculty group can also write it. And MST through KA, even if they're not in these groups, can read, write, or execute. And TJ1A, even if they are in those groups, cannot access the file at all. Questions? Okay, so this is what sort of the access control lists look like. And as for setting them on files, there are like two commands we'll end up using in the lab for that. So one is get facl, is to list that. We'll just output that sort of file. And one is set facl, which will modify that list. You can add a line to it, add a line to the list of rules, or sort of remove one. Or you can like load a file of rules that you've written earlier and apply it, you know, to restrict who can access a particular other file. Yes?
Is there any sort of rule hierarchy, or do rules never overlap?
Question, is there any sort of rule hierarchy? There are rules for how to deal with the overlap. I don't know all the details of them. I mentioned user takes precedent over groups, and I gather there are ways of handling other sort of contradictory cases. But I don't know all the details. I'd have to look them up. Other questions? So we've talked about sort of these two ways of specifying who can access files. And there's also some other operations, you know, that kind of use the same kind of information. And generally, the rule is that whenever we have these types of restrictions, how does the system enforce them? Well, basically, you're doing something that needs a system call. And part of that system call handler is going to check the user IDs, the group IDs, et cetera, versus who's allowed to access the file or do some other operation. So for example, if I'm on portal, I can't kill your programs. And that's because the operating system is checking, is the program that you're trying to kill, does it have the same user ID as you do? And if the answer is no, it's going to say, you can't do that. So that's another one of these checks. And in the same way, if I try to open a file, it says, does the file sort of have an access control list or those, you know, read, write, and execute bits that suggest you should be able to access it based on your user ID and group ID right now? Some questions about this checking? So I mentioned this is done in sort of the system call handlers. So how could we change that? So that's how it's typically done. Which of these things could we do instead and have things still work, still be secure? Give a minute. Who'd like some more time? Okay. Okay, so let's see. So who thinks A would be okay to do? Thinks A would not be okay? Couple. Who thinks B would be okay to do? Thinks B would not be okay to do? Most people. Who thinks C would be okay to do? Thinks C would not be okay to do? Okay, so we have reasonable consensus that A is okay, yeah. Their check's redundant. There's not a good reason to do it, but we can do it, and it's not going to change anything. It's just going to be wasting time, basically, because, you know, things rarely do we have errors, and now we're just making us, you know, check twice for the errors instead of once. B, most people agreed, would not be okay. And the reason why is because, well, usually, we use the standard library to make system calls. So if these permissions were just about, you know, preventing mistakes, this would be fine. But they're not just about preventing mistakes. They're about keeping me from being able to do things. And I don't have to use the standard library to make a system call. Even though usually you would, I don't have to do it. And we need some way where I can't just, you know, not use that the check. You know, I shouldn't have that option. So that is not okay to do. So C, there's more mixed opinions on. Can we make it a system call argument rather than having the OS track it somewhere and look it up? And the problem is that, you know, even though, you know, the way we'd implement this is I'd like call a library function and would add my user ID as an argument, I don't have to use that function. I can write my own function that makes system calls that runs that special syscall instruction. And it can set that system call argument however it wants. I don't have to use the library function that would set it correctly. So I could fool the system this way. So we have to have the user ID stored somewhere that normal code can't mess with it. So questions? This idea? Any of the cases here? Okay, so a missing piece we haven't gotten to is dealing with sort of things system administrators can do and logging in. So there's a special user ID on Unix systems called, which is user ID 0, typically called root, sometimes super user. And most non-Unix systems like Windows have an equivalent of this. So in Windows, it's called administrator or system. And this is special in that many system calls only work if your user ID is 0. So for example, there's a system call on Linux to shut the system down. It only works if your user ID is 0. That's just hard-coded that user ID 0 is allowed to do things no one else is allowed to do. And also, basically, this user ID bypasses pretty much all permission checks. So the open function normally would check, is the user ID okay? You know, does it match the user ID of the file and does it have read access? For user ID 0, it just skips that. And that's where the name super user comes from, because well, you can do anything that you can do with a system call as this user. So you can kind of think as super user as like it's not kernel mode, but because the system calls just say yes, it gives you sort of kind of more access than typical users. So it's kind of like, you know, a special mode in that sense of a similar sort to kernel versus user mode. We have super user versus normal user. Okay, so that's a user for administrators. And the reason I'm bringing this up is we have to talk about a program that for logging in. So you step up to a machine, you type a username and a password, and somehow you get a shell. And this is not something that's typically handled by like special OS code. This is a normal program that you can log into. You type in a username and password, and it figures out if that password's correct, and then somehow runs a terminal for you as your user ID. And remember I told you that the kernel, that sort of core OS code, doesn't know anything about usernames. So this is not something the kernel is doing. So instead, we have a program that is going to run as root, so it has permission to do anything, and it's going to make a system call to change user IDs to run programs as the user ID you logged in as, and it's going to start by running your shell. So you can type commands. Some questions? This? So this is how sort of login programs work, including like SSHing into a machine. So there's a program running as root that's able to change to your user ID when it figures out it's in fact you. And in order to do this, it needs to check the passwords. You might think that, oh, that must be something done by the kernel. Typically, it's not. Typically, this is just going to be stored in some file or some network service that is only accessible to super user, to user ID 0. And it's just going to check versus that file or contact a network service that only user ID 0 has the sort of password to access. Yes?
So since the login program would change user ID to you on successful login, does that mean it never returns while the machine is up?
Question, since the login program will change user ID to you, does that mean it never returns while the system is up? Later in the semester, we're going to talk about how we start programs from other programs. It's basically going to turn out that there's the original login program will still be running and it will start a new program that changes user IDs. Does that answer your question?
So once it does that, it can pass the baton of the login process and exit?
Question, once it does that, it can exit. So if we think of like an SSH server or sitting in front of a machine, we want some program that can be that can resume running when you log out or that can handle more connections. So generally, there will be something running, but it will start a new program that changes user IDs. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes? Okay. And okay, so, and there's a system call on Linux, or a library call that makes a system call to change user IDs. And if you're a super user, it just works. Otherwise, it, you know, probably is going to fail. It's probably going to return an error. So another thing that some of you are familiar with is sudo. So sudo is this command where you're running as a normal user, you run sudo, and somehow you can run a program as user ID 0 with that super user permissions. I just told you, set UID better not work as you. Right? It shouldn't work. So how does this work? And the answer is that the sudo program is special. It's marked with an extra bit in the file system called the set user ID bit. And the system call that runs a program, so the exec, this is the execute program, system call, when it sees that bit set, when you run that program, it changes the your effective user ID to the owner of the file. So this is owned by user ID 0, and when you run it, it runs as user ID 0, not as you. And how do you set that bit? It turns out that the way it's set, you can set it with chmod, with u plus s, s for set UID. And on a typical Linux system, you actually, there's a lot of cases where you'll run set user ID programs because they're things that the normal system calls won't let you do that you'd want to do. And this isn't just cases where you're using your administrator access like here. Like here, we're a system administrator apparently, and we're configured to be allowed to just type our password and run things as root. But even normal users commonly will run programs that work the same way as sudo and get to run as root on your behalf and decide to do things that you couldn't do. So one example is when I have a Linux machine and I plug in a USB stick, manipulating the file systems is normally restricted to just user ID 0. But there's some program that runs that lets me do that for USB sticks, but doesn't let me like change whether the hard drive is set up or not. When I'm talking to a printer, usually programs can't do that directly, but you know, there might be programs that run set user ID to like set up access to a device, you know, that most users aren't allowed to. And other things like that. So this is basically a general mechanism where the system administrator can have programs that are installed that let users do things that they normally wouldn't be allowed to do, and they didn't have to modify the like code that handles open to do it, or and all those system calls. They just wrote a program, and the user runs the program, and the program does the things for them, rather than adding extra cases to the system calls to like say, oh, this user can shut the system down, and other users can't. Instead, you install a program that says, if you're this user, call shutdown. And if that program runs as root, it'll just work. Okay. So questions on this set user ID idea? Yeah.
Are there permission checks for the sudo command itself to prevent users, so like non-root users from doing things like shutdown?
The question, are there checks for the sudo command itself? Yes. So the sudo program basically has in the sudo program, its main is basically if you are allowed in the config file, do it else print error. So the program we're running as user ID 0 has this if statement basically saying, if you're actually allowed to do it, otherwise don't. And in this way, the system administrator, they can write whatever they want for that if statement basically, so they can let you do whatever things they want you to do without modifying the kernel code. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So in that way, like you can write your own, writing set user ID programs is a way where you can just let users do any particular thing, but not let them do other things without somehow reconfiguring the OS. So another common example might be, if you want to let some users shut down the system, you can write a program that lets them do that, but only lets them do that in certain ways. And how does it only let them do that in certain ways? Well, the program does something before calling the shutdown system call. And always make sure that always happens. Other questions about this? Set user ID. Yeah. Sorry? This question, do you only use set user ID to set the user ID to 0? That is by far the most common use, but you could use it to set it to some other user ID. So something I'd like to note about set user ID is that it seems like a very nice thing that's useful. It turns out that it's probably a mistake. And the reason why it's probably a mistake is that it's really easy to have a bug in a set user ID program, especially because the program can be run in all sorts of weird ways, right? It's just a command. I can run it however I want. I can do all these weird things with it. And this is one of the most common causes of what we call privilege escalation, that you can run, do something weird and get access to things you're not supposed to have access to. So for example, sudo in the past, some versions of sudo have had very subtle bugs where you could cause a buffer overflow by setting an environment variable before running it, and therefore have it skip its configuration check and just let you run things. And that's really bad. And it's really hard to prevent because you have so much control over how the program is run, like much more so than like bugs on a web server. Okay, so questions? Okay, yes. Are there examples of other examples of this happening? Yes, I would need to look some up. There was a proof of concept for the sudo vulnerability I was mentioning. I could look up. It is not simple. Okay. Now.